This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with Amira Haas, the only Israeli journalist to have spent years living in and reporting from Gaza and the West Bank.
Would there really have been any difference in the plight of the Palestinians had the Zionist Union won and not Netanyahu?
We'll hear how Palestinian solidarity activists are being called anti-Semites on college campuses.
And we'll hear, ironically, how Netanyahu's election may increase Palestinian activism.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Last week, during Israeli elections, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed that as long as he leads the country, there will be no Palestinian state. Today we ask, how will this recent election affect the future of a Palestinian state, Palestinian refugees, the right of return, and the continuing occupation of the West Bank and settlements? Interestingly, in a fact left out of most U.S. coverage of the elections, the opposition parties were not much better. They want to keep the major settlement blocks, keep all of Jerusalem, and don't believe in any right of return. Today we're joined by Haaretz correspondent Amira Haas, the only Israeli journalist to have spent many, many years living in and reporting from Gaza and the West Bank. Haas writes a regular column in our Haaretz newspaper, is the author of many books including Drinking the Sea at Gaza, Days and Nights in a Land Under Siege, as well as her new book about her mother, Diary of Bergen-Belsen, 1944 to 1945.
Amira Haas, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Hi.
It's good to see you again, and here we are the day after the results of the recent Israeli election. And I guess the first question to you is, was it a surprise to you, the results? And what do you think of these results?
I must say that for me it wasn't a surprise, even though the polls were predicting for the past, I don't know, 3 months, we were fed up every morning, every day almost by a new poll that predicted Netanyahu's decline or Likud's decline or 20 seats or 19 seats. And I'm naturally suspicious of polls because until the moment, I mean, we've had so many times that predicted the opposite of what really happened. But this time, everybody seemed convinced that there would be a gap and that the Labour Party in its new incarnation, the Zionist camp, will get more seats. But even though I kept saying, when I was asked mostly by Palestinians, I said that the right-wing bloc is very strong. It won't change. Maybe something of the configuration within the bloc, the right-wing bloc, would change a bit. But there wouldn't be a real shift, even not to the center. Let's make it clear that the Zionist camp is not left-wing, even though Netanyahu keeps saying the left-wing, and he means the Zionist camp or Labor. Let's make it clear. It's at best center-right. And it has some people who are a bit more social justice-leaning and a bit more sober when it comes to the Palestinians, but as a whole, if we can say it's the Labour Party which paved the road to where we are now. It's the Labour which during...
That's a profound
yes,
thought.
Yeah.
Please explain that.
Not only because Labour are the real experts in colonial enterprise, and they have been so since the 20s and the 30s, the Labour movement, but also, let's be more recent... The Palestinians gave us and gave Labour a golden opportunity in 1993 when they signed the Oslo Accords. Palestinians, Israeli peace camp, the world understood that by this Oslo Accords should lead to a two-state solution. But the two-state in its original form, Gaza-West Bank, connection between Gaza and the West Bank, 67 borders, I mean pre-war 67 borders, is Jerusalem as a capital of the Palestinian state, sovereignty, full sovereignty, and discussion over solving the refugee issue in one way or the other, but by consent. This was the idea. But the real smartasses of the Labour Party, which negotiated with the Palestinians, drafted such an accord where you didn't have this goal as an end. I mean, the goal of the two-state solution. They misled so many people, Palestinians included, international community. They did not draft an accord, an agreement, or a contract, you would say, a deal which says our goal is to reach the two-state solution gradually. They had the gradual thing, but without the goal. So that's why we are here. We are keeping it's a process which goes on and on and on and on. But the invention of this as a process which goes on and on and on and on was not the invention of Likud. It was the invention of labor. Peres, Shimon Peres, who is acclaimed in the world as a big peacemaker, and also Rabin. Also Rabin is in charge, and Yossi Beilin. So all these figures that are, adopted or embraced as peacemakers actually were smart enough to arrange such a situation that leads nowhere and that allows actually Israel. It perpetuates the status quo, but the status quo keeps changing in favor of the colonialist Israel. That's why you could have the number of settlers almost doubled since 91, since 92. So in that sense, I mean, I don't say that it's only labor. It was before that. It was also Likud. In that sense, there is no big difference between labor and Likud. But labor were in place when the Oslo Accords were signed. It was a present that the Palestinians gave to us. Why present? Because it was an acknowledgement on the part of the Palestinians. Yeah, you could say they acknowledge that they are a weaker party and they want a statehood, and even a state in the 23% of Palestine is okay. All right, all this is correct. But there was something else when one listened to the Palestinians negotiating at that time, and especially Palestinians who supported this accord from inside the occupied territory. They accepted the Israeli society. I mean, they really accepted it as something that exists, has its faults, but also has its things to like. They knew Israelis. They met them either at work or in prison or in many other circumstances, peace activists or anti-occupation activists. And they accepted the Israeli society. They saw it. They knew it exists. It is there. You cannot make it disappear. So in a way, they said they accepted some kind of a more nuanced historiography of the state of Israel, a historiography that did not only analyze Israel, the very existence of Israeli state, only as a colonialist or as a product of colonialist times and colonialist movement. But they also understood, even not verbally, the historiography that connects Israel to that part of history, of European history, that made it possible. I mean, the 12 years of the Third Reich. Because without the 12 years of Nazi rule, most of the Jews would not have chosen to emigrate to Palestine. And if Canada, South America, would have not resisted the immigration of Jews, many Jews would have preferred to move to America, to emigrate to America and not to Palestine. So within the Oslo Accords, from the Palestinian side, there was a potential of including these two historiographies which make the state of Israel. The historiography of a colonialist movement in being developed in colonialist times in Europe, the 19th century, and outside of a context of a the building of national states. And on the other hand, historiography of a refuge for people who were kicked out by the diaspora, a people of the diaspora, which was kicked out from the diaspora against its will, and more or less the only place that they found and felt secure at that time was Palestine, at the back of the Palestinians. But still, the enormity of this chapter in history should not be overlooked.
Well, now you have the newly elected for the fourth time Netanyahu, who many people regard as a war criminal, saying publicly to drum up votes that he would never recognize a Palestine state, reneging on a promise that he had made, however insincere, in 2009. Those of us who live in the United States, another colonial enterprise, see what happened to Native Americans. They're pretty much disappeared here and terribly oppressed and impoverished. And we wonder what's going to happen to Palestinians.
You cannot compare. I mean, Palestinians are not vanishing. Palestinians are not a minority in the region. Indigenous Americans were made into a minority very quickly with white migration. But the Palestinians are not a minority. They're a majority in the region. And even in Israel or in the country, from the river to the sea, they're almost half of the population, almost half. And soon there might be more. Also, the Israeli policies, we have to be very strict about this, are not genocidal policies. Yes, Gaza was, there was a lot of killing or murder by aeroplanes in Gaza, three times and more. But the essence of Israeli repression and colonialism is not about elimination of a people, thankfully. It's almost 70 years since the State of Israel, and the Palestinians are, as a people, they grow. They were about 2-3 million or 2 million, and now they are about 13. So we are not talking about genocide and genocidal policies as the policies of United States.
But could we be talking about others. Ethnocide? About
yeah, there is. Out? There is no ethnocide again. I mean, I'm very careful about using the suffix side. Side, it's about complete annihilation. It is ethnic cleansing. And actually what the policies of Israeli governments since the Oslo Accords, and in some part in Israel proper since 48, the essence of Israeli policies, or you can translate and see in the Israeli policies some sort of a compromise. Which kind of compromise? A compromise, internal Israeli compromise, between the DNA urge to expel all Palestinians from the country and the realization that this is impossible. So what does the compromise do? The compromise concentrates Palestinians in Bantustans, in reservations, you could say. When you go, you see, this is the process that has been happening in the West Bank for the past 20 years. You know, parallel to the Oslo process and to the whole world talking, we are talking about the peace process and Oslo process, etc. We are reaching peace, etc. What Israel did very, very artfully, and this is again to the credit of the main colonialist philosophy of the Labour Party, it concentrated Palestinians into their areas, determined as A areas. You look at the map and you see the enclaves, the Palestinian enclaves. Before Oslo, the map that everybody had in his or her mind, of the map of the West Bank, was Israeli settlements scattered like spots in the entire West Bank, which was considered Palestinian. So there are all kind of villages and cities, Palestinian villages, and Palestinians had the freedom of movement. And the Israeli settlements were scattered, Israeli colonies actually were scattered all around. Slowly, slowly, especially with the progress of the Oslo process, the settlers, the dots of the settlements became the bulk, became the ocean, and the Palestinian villages and towns became the spots, the dots, the enclaves encircled by Israeli territory. This is the process of the past 20 years. This is the real process. And the elections today are the product of this process of 20, 25 years of Israelis feeling okay with this. With this compromise. Okay, it's okay.
Yeah, go.
When you look at the geography of Palestinians in Israel, it's the same geography. They are encircled in enclaves. They are deprived of their land. They could not, most of their land has been taken by Israel for Jews to settle. inside them, even though they are Israeli citizens. And you look and you see their villages and villages turned into towns, and they are all cramped and crept and packed with houses without space to breathe, deprived of their agricultural land and other lands. And this is very similar. When you look, you see the similar. So that's the geography of Israeli state. The political geography of Israeli state is very similar in both parts of the Green Line.
So now that you've left us with this, I mean, I'm not looking forward to tomorrow, I'll put it that way.
No.
So how do you see the future? I mean, you have 13 million, as you said, Palestinians
not
living
only, no, you have
within and living
road,
outside.
Yes,
I understand, living in Jordan and living in Syria. And living in Lebanon, really. But
living in Syria now is a big term,
Right. So you have that, and then you have a president who now gives voice, we're not going to have a Palestinian state, which is, of course,
Prime Minister.
So where's it going to go from here? And what's the international community, which has always put forward, two states, and let's work on the peace process. What's next?
The big mistake when we are talking about elections before and after is that we always look at the short term. So it's not about the short term. And for me, there isn't much change, even though he said it openly yesterday, no state. Okay, but in practice, that's what they have been doing. So maybe it's good that he said it because it will expose more Western and American collaboration or compliance with this. I don't know. Israelis would not change the situation because as long as Israelis profit in general from this status quo, they don't have a reason to change. It's true about any group, privileged group in the world, be it men, be it whites, be it, everywhere it's true. So we're not unique in that sense. Because of, my left background, I have a strong belief and also expectation from the Palestinians to change and keep improving their tactics and strategies fighting the Israeli occupation and domination in general. It's not just it's an occupation, but it's other forms also of domination. Not because they are responsible, no, but because they have an interest to change the status quo. So right now, these elections, the good thing that these elections brought us is the joint list of the Arab parties. Which, of course, for a group of Israeli Jewish activists, it was the natural address to vote for.
Tell our listeners what that is, because they won't know.
The joint list is formed by four parties. Two of them were already in some sort of a strange alliance before, and I think they had four members of parliament out of 120. Then there is Arab National Democratic Alliance, Balad, or Tajamo, which had three members, and the four members of the Communist Party, the Front for Peace and Equality, where the main body is the Communist Party and some groups around it and activists. And now, since Avigdor Lieberman, the racist Avigdor Lieberman, the emigrant Avigdor Lieberman, wanted to oust them from political life, to kind of make them disappear, he had the genius suggestion to raise the threshold for entering the parliament. And some parties, I don't remember right now, I should have checked it, but some rights of the center right joined in and said, no, it's for better governance. One should raise the threshold because of all these small parties. But everybody knew that this is meant to... This is targeting the Arab parties, not anybody else. Okay, so what they did, and there was a struggle to do it. These four parties, which including one which is Islamic, the Islamists, and a soft nationalist party, they overcame all their natural differences, because Arabs, like everybody, have different opinions. So they overcame these differences and made a joint list. It's not a united party. It's a joint list respecting the differences, but agreeing that now the most important thing is to indeed to defy the right wing's wish to make them disappear. Because if you disappear from the Knesset, it does expose their will to see them also disappearing from other parts of our life. And that was very important. I wrote in favor of it at Haaretz, knowing that, you know, my friends in these parties will also read me, because there was this position, for example, leftists and feminists opposed to be together with Islamists because they don't respect women's rights. And then there is animosity between the Communist Party and Ballad Party, because Ballad Party came out partly from the Communist Party. So you have, you know, like you have everywhere. And luckily, because I live in Ramallah, I don't go deeply into those animosities. So I was not so much aware of it, like some other friends. And at the end, they overcame and they had a joint list. And they put as the head of it also what was good is that instead of an old guy, I mean, he's not so old. He was there for so many years at the head of the Communist Party or the Communist List. And he gave his place to somebody fresh and new, who is a novelty, because what's good about him that maybe he's not has not been angered too long. So he, confronting all those racist, poisonous language in a very soft way, very convincing, doesn't fall into the trap of shouting or cursing or whatever. Ayman Oda, his name. So there was a change in the whole list, and there was something refreshing about it. The turnout was a bit disappointing to me. We hoped that there would be a higher turnout among Arabs in Israel. It was more than 4 years or 2 years ago, but still not enough. But there is they feel that they can do something. You know, you're not just a passive recipient of your oppression and the discrimination, but you can do something to turn the table upside down, or to change some of the rules of the game. And I hope that this will be a sign also for Palestinians inside the West Bank and Gaza, because one of the main obstacles now for any big change in their politics is this terrible rift between Hamas and Fatah. And the fact that they are both fighting for the very, very dubious prestige or title of the leader of the Palestinian people. Or a government, Palestinian government. So this was the positive. If you want something positive, this was the positive.
What percentage did they win?
They got 14 seats.
Which
out
is
of
quite,
100. It was yeah. It's 3 seats better than the last right. time. And also, if they didn't go together, for sure the Ballad Party would not have. I mean, it's very likely that the Ballad Party would not have crossed the threshold. Right.
We're speaking with Amira Haas, an award-winning Israeli journalist. Amira, the joint list also has progressive stances on domestic issues in Israel, as opposed to the Netanyahu right wing. And so my question to you is, because this is a phenomenon that happens in the United States, where people vote against their own interests and vote for right-wing people in the United States. And it seems to me that that's what a lot of Israelis did. I mean, there. I suppose you could try to figure out in what ways Israelis benefit from the occupation in terms of water or having the chance to move over there and getting subsidized. But generally speaking, Israelis really don't profit from the occupation. But nonetheless, they vote for this right-wing guy that has right-wing politics when it comes to social policies in Israel. What does the joint list stand for? And do you think that they've got a prospect for winning over more Israelis to it in the same way that Matzpin in the old days tried to work between Arabs and Jews in a joint way?
Let's hope he'll be more successful than Matzpin. Yeah, let's hope he'll be more successful than Matzpin.
Yes,
it's not... Look, of course, I mean, you say the journalist, I'm a leftist at first. I mean, it's not a secret. And I've always voted for an Arab party because for the Communist Party, I was not part of the party, but that was the party that I could vote because it combined, because it was not, at least nominally, nationalist, but addressed the whole issues of, many issues of social justice. Inside Israel, okay, there are contradictions, but we don't have the time to enter all the contradictions. But look, in the short run, Israelis do profit from the occupation. because a solution, a two-state solution, the way we saw it, would have had a dynamics which slowly, slowly erodes Jewish privileges in the country. If you don't have needs for security, I mean, you cannot have the pretext of security. You don't need the army. You cannot explain by security the discrimination against Palestinians in Israel, Israeli citizens. So there are many ways. The water, of course, don't underestimate it. So Israeli Jews vote in general for those who perpetuate the situation of profiteering from the profiteering, you can say. When will they understand that this is, I mean, in the long run, that this might be might act against us? We've been warning about it for the past 40 years, of almost 50 years. So maybe we are wrong. You know, why? Maybe we are wrong, and people think maybe in their thinking and understanding is as short as their lifespan. And since their lifespan has shown that we profit from the occupation, let's continue. Now, I know it's wrong, but I'm a bit cautious in saying that Israelis do not understand what's good for them. They understand what's good for them right now as nationalists, as with promises from God and promises from the Bible, and so they interpret that this is good for them, and we have you know. Land deeds from God. This is every chapter in the Bible has a land deed for us. So, but yes, I can of course end with a question that once I was asked by two very different Palestinians, coincidentally in the same week, one by a simple farmer who is being attacked on a regular basis by settlers, and the other one by Saeb Arikat, the permanent negotiator on the Palestinian side, and we are not friends, but he asked me once after being very tired, giving me, it was almost 15 years ago, or even more, 18 years ago, so after one of his very depressing talks, useless meetings with an Israeli official, he asked me, "Tell me, Amira, don't Israelis think about their grandchildren?" And this farmer asked me the same thing, the very same thing. After he told me about how he was attacked by dogs and by settlers, he said, almost the same sentence. Tell me, Amira, don't Israelis think about their grandchildren?
Amira Haas, it's just been, I mean, spectacularly wonderful to have you. It's really been great. And your work, of course, over the years. But this is really extraordinary. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Amira.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.
boycott, divestment, sanction, or BDS movement gains traction on college campuses, anti-Arab sentiment rears its head in many forms. For example, since the University of California Student Association passed a resolution recommending divestment, posters with violent images calling Palestine Solidarity activists anti-Semites and terrorists have appeared on multiple college campuses, including Drake, DePaul, UMass at Amherst, University of California in Irvine, and the University of California in Los Angeles. We talk about that. And in another show of solidarity with Palestinians, the annual Jewish Voice for Peace National Gathering had a record attendance. We talk about that. Last summer's assault on Gaza led to a huge boom in JVP membership and donations and a shift to the left among some liberal Zionists who decided to join JVP. We're joined today by Alex Kane, a freelance journalist writing for Mondo Weiss and a graduate student in Mideastern Studies at New York University. Alex Kane, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
You're fresh back from the Jewish Voice for Peace conference. There's a lot of action with the Students for Justice in Palestine getting repressed. Netanyahu just got elected for the fourth time. So there's a lot going on. So my overall question is, coming back from the Jewish Voice for Peace conference, are you optimistic about building the movement in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. I mean, you know, the Jewish Voice for Peace conference was quite remarkable. This was my first ever time covering the Jewish Voice for Peace national membership meeting. But, you know, I talked to a lot of people there that had been involved with JVP since the late 90s, which is when they started. And they said, you know, we used to go to Jewish Voice for Peace meetings, and there were, you know, 10 to 15 people meeting in the living room. And, you know, they had slowly started to build, and they kind of institutionalized themselves and got offices around the country. But this was their biggest conference yet. You had over 500 people coming, you know, most of them Jewish, although there were some non-Jews there as well that are sort of allies of Jewish Voice for Peace. And the conference was quite remarkable for a number of reasons. I mean, one was just the sheer number of people and the excitement that people had. And the other is sort of how Jewish Voice for Peace is placing itself in relation to other sort of movements for justice in the U.S., the Black Lives Matter movement and immigration rights and so on. You know, that was a big theme of the conference as well. So, you know, Jewish Voice for Peace is going to continue to grow as the situation gets worse in Israel. That's kind of the productive tension from this conference. You know, the reason why Jewish Voice for Peace is growing is because the assaults on Gaza, is because the continued building of settlements in Jerusalem and the West Bank. So there's that tension that, you know, Jewish Voice for Peace, they're you know, and Students for Justice in Palestine, the main campus group for Palestine Solidarity, they're going to continue to grow as the situation gets worse. So in a way, the Netanyahu win that you referenced is a gift to Jewish Voice for Peace, Students for Justice in Palestine, and the larger boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement.
Yeah, well, they give with one hand what they take away with the other. It seems clear that the Palestinians are going to have a much tougher time now than they even have been having.
That's true. There's one sort of stream of thought that, you know, as things get worse, as Netanyahu stays in office, that it kind of exposes the true face of Israel to the world. There's also, you know, of course, another stream of thought on the left that, well, things are going to get worse in Israel, and that's bad for Palestinians. The situation in Israel won't change much, even if the Labor Party was in power, which they're not going to be. But if the Labor Party, the Zionist Union, won, I don't see the situation even getting better. So I tend to agree with the folks that think it's better for Netanyahu to be in office.
Yeah, Ali Abu Nima of Electronic Intifada wrote a piece similar to that, saying at least now we know it's like the contents of a box of food. At least now you know what's in the box openly and publicly, and you're not hiding behind the peace process.
I think that's true. You know, I mean, there were some people that said, we want the Zionist Union to be in power, even if they didn't agree with the Zionist Union, because this would maybe lift some pressure off Palestinians. But if you look at the history of the Labor Party, which the Zionist Union the Labor Party was a part of the Zionist Union. If you look at the history, it doesn't give me much hope. I mean, and other centrist parties, you know, in 2009, when Israel invaded Gaza for Operation Cast Lead, the head of the government was Ehud Olmert, who was a centrist prime minister. And you had Ehud Barak, also presiding over many, you know, wars in Lebanon and Gaza. So again, the history does not give me hope that the Zionist Union would be any better than Netanyahu in terms of war, in terms of issues of war and peace.
Now, I know, Alex, you cover a lot of domestic opposition to what's going on with Palestinians. That's happening in the United States, both Students for Justice in Palestine as well as JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace. Can you talk about what's going on campuses and the kind of resistance they're getting? You had an article up recently about inflammatory posters at UCLA and otherwise, but there's a lot of opposition apparently of some sort going on to these organizations who are asking for Palestinian rights.
Yeah, so, you know, since 2005, which is when hundreds of organizations in Palestinian society called for boycott, divestment, and sanctions targeting Israel, the kind of campus movement for justice in Palestine has grown exponentially. So you had dozens of new Students for Justice in Palestine chapters cropping up, even Jewish Voice for Peace chapters on campus, and you know they're broadening the discourse on campus. They're bringing up issues of Palestinian human rights, and they're pushing for divestment resolutions on the, from their student government. So they're sort of authoring these resolutions, calling for their universities to divest their holdings in corporations like Caterpillar, which builds bulldozers for the Israeli army. Corporations like Raytheon, which gives the Israeli military equipment that they use to carry out their assaults on Gaza. So you have these students calling on their student governments to divest from these companies. And so most of the resolutions are symbolic because the student governments can't force their universities to divest, but it does lead to a broadening of the discourse and a kind of push in media coverage and increase in sort of solidarity with Palestine. And that has been happening more and more and more in recent years. The opposition, of course, has come out strongly. And the opposition really ranges from, you know, well-funded right-wing pro-Israel groups to even the Israeli government. I recently wrote a story based on documents that were leaked to me from Northwestern, where it showed that the Hillel at Northwestern had partnered with groups like Stand With Us, which is a sort of far-right pro-Israel group in the U.S., but also the Israeli consulate was involved. This is really remarkable. You have the Israeli consulate getting involved with campus politics in the U.S., and it's not limited to Northwestern. So you really have this well sort of funded, powerful network of opposition that are trying to beat back these divestment resolutions. But so far, the sort of students on campus realize that the situation in Israel-Palestine is getting worse, and that you know they're following the heat of the sort of call of the BDS movement and are calling for divestment from these companies.
Now, Alex, some of the posters in response to the student movements are quite violent, charging anti-Semitism, Jew haters. What has been the response of various academic institutions, administrations to this kind of hate rhetoric?
This type of hateful rhetoric is sort of easily opposed by university presidents. I mean, you know, the UCLA president, after these posters we found out that David Horowitz, sort of the right-wing bomb thrower, was behind these posters. You know, these were, like, incredibly inflammatory. So you have, you know, it's very easy for university presidents to come out against these incredibly hateful anti-Muslim posters. On the other hand, the same university presidents, I think, are part of this sort of larger crackdown on Palestine solidarity activism on campus. So, for example, at Northeastern in Boston, you had last year that they suspended their Students for Justice in Palestine chapter. And this year, actually,
that was for the campaign about housing demolition.
That's right. That's right. That was part of it. The Northeastern Students for Justice in Palestine had issued sort of mock pamphlets to students saying, you know, we're going to demolish your dorm room as a way to dramatize what Palestinians go through. In response to that and other actions that they had taken, the administration suspended them. And this year, actually, Northeastern is trying to push for a divestment resolution campus-wide to have all the students vote on whether their school should divest from companies involved with the Israeli military. At first, the student government actually said that, no, you're not allowed to vote on it. There's been some back and forth, and now it seems that there will be a vote on whether to divest. But that's just an example of the kind of difficulties that these groups are facing. And, you know, you talk to Students for Justice and Palestine activists across the country, and they say, you know, we always have difficulty with the administration. We have difficulty getting funding from the administration, you know, as other student groups do. And so there's this real climate of kind of fear around SJP and a crackdown on what they're trying to do.
So in light of this election, how do you think that's going to affect the movements, the pro-Palestinian movements in this country?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think as I mentioned before that there's a stream of thought that, you know, as things get worse in Israel-Palestine, things will get better in terms of the justice movement in the U.S. And I think that is true. You know, Benjamin Netanyahu is the greatest gift to the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, and the fact that he won is in a way a victory for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, because when you have someone like Zippy Livni in power or other the Labour Party in power, and them representing the face of Israel to the international community, it's a much more refined face. It's a much kind of more palatable face, and you know they're going to engage in negotiations with the Palestinian Authority, and that's going to take off the international pressure from Israel. But the fact that you have Netanyahu in power, I think, is going to boost the divestment resolutions that SJPs are bringing up. It's going to boost the larger BDS movement. And you're going to see, I think, even more of an increase in activity when it comes to activism for Palestine in the U.S., because Netanyahu, in the last week of his campaign, said he's never going to agree to a Palestinian state, that, you know, he also said, you know, the Arab voters, you better go out to vote because the Arabs are going to take over in Israel itself. And so this kind of racism clarifies things to a lot of people. You know, Israeli racism has always been there, of course, and even under the Labour Party. But the fact that Netanyahu is in power and saying openly, you know, sort of race baiting in terms of how he relates to the Palestinian citizens is remarkable, and will only serve to increase the power of the BDS movement in the U.S.
You know, Netanyahu a few weeks ago addressed the U.S. Congress, or a majority of the U.S. Congress, or the House, really, the House of Representatives. And can you talk about what effect that had on at least the student movement in this country?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the student movement, I think, you know, many students, you know, sort of saw this as a further confirmation of why they're doing this work. They're doing this work in the U.S. because the U.S. is Israel's major benefactor. You know, the U.S. gives Israel over $3 billion a year in military aid. And so this is why students are in the U.S. are so invested. And this is why the movement for Palestine has grown so much. You know, it's not the movement for, say, a free Tibet is not sort of surging on campuses. And I think that's largely because they don't see such a big stake in terms of their tax dollars, in terms of their government being so involved. And, you know, I think the students and particularly Jewish Voice for Peace as well were really buoyed by the fact that 60 members of Congress had boycotted Netanyahu's speech. And that doesn't mean that there's going to be a change in U.S. policy right now. There's not. You know, the sort of strength of the U.S.-Israel relationship remains. But I think that the rhetorical tensions between Obama and Netanyahu and the kind of disrespect that Netanyahu has shown to the U.S. president has created some space on the left for them to get their message out that, you know, the U.S. should not be funding Israel to the tune of $3.1 billion a year.
Now, this is where we've had your, I don't know if he's your boss or not, the guy who runs Mondo Weiss, Phil Weiss. And we argue about this all the time.
Right.
And, of course, I do see two things happening right now. One, I see one tendency is, and I see some of the organizations doing it, and I don't care for it particularly, is thinking they can actually move Congress at all. I don't think that at all. I saw a huge movement in when we had El Salvador War, et cetera, much bigger than we can ever get. Congress never voted to stop the aid to El Salvador, essentially, and to the military government. So I find that to be, fine for a little outlet, but mostly a waste of time. So the fact that 60 people didn't show up for Netanyahu's speech doesn't mean they wouldn't show up for Livni's speech or for Herzog's speech, and those people have roughly the same policies. So I'm not convinced of that. And the second thing that I'm not convinced of, and it's a difference with Phil, and I'm interested in your thoughts, is the emphasis on the Israeli lobby versus the strategic interest of the United States to have one country in the Middle East who they consider to be stable with 200 atomic weapons. I'm not convinced on that level. I am convinced on the BDS level, but I just like your reaction to both those statements. One about Congress, and secondly about where we're going on the other issues of lobby versus strategic interests.
In terms of Congress, I don't think it's a waste of time. But I do. I'm sympathetic to, you know, people who want to focus on the BDS movement and sort of movement building. But I don't think that they're mutually exclusive. You know, I think, you know, Jewish Voice for Peace, for instance, just recently hired someone to do work on Capitol Hill, their federal policy director. And there are certainly some folks within Jewish Voice for Peace that I've spoken to that are kind of worried, oh, will Jewish Voice for Peace get co-opted, or will, you know, this focus on Washington sort of take away from their larger work? But I think I'm convinced that that is not mutually exclusive, that, you know, you can both try to open up space on Capitol Hill as well as building a larger movement that will in turn affect what's going on in Washington, D.C. So I don't think it's a zero-sum game. In terms of the second question, you know, I think the negotiations with Iran are really clarifying this. So you have the Obama administration seems to be going towards an agreement with Iran, and this is in opposition to what the pro-Israel lobby AIPAC wants and what the Israeli government wants. I think that that tells us that the U.S. has its own interest as a sort of empire, as a hegemon in the Middle East, and that they think that reducing tensions with Iran will smooth out kind of the workings of U.S. empire and will help out in the sort of fight against ISIS. You know, they're basically working with Iran in the fight against ISIS and so on. I think that shows you that the Israel lobby does not drive all U.S. foreign policy when it comes to the Middle East. And so I agree with you on sort of that sense. On the other hand, when there is no key U.S. interest, say in terms of the Palestinians, the U.S. doesn't really care, frankly, whether the Palestinians have a state or not. I don't think that this is a huge core interest of the Obama administration. Whether to get, you know, they say yes, we want a two-state solution, but they're not exerting any real power towards that as they are on Iran. And I think that this shows that when there is no real opposition, you know, to that in Washington in terms of the Israel lobby versus sort of pro-Palestinian activists, that you're going to have the Israel lobby drive the policy on that. So I think the lobby is most powerful when its sort of larger interests has no significant opposition in Washington. And in a sense, you know, they can tell the administration, look, you know, don't push for a two-state solution and sort of use their tricks of campaign contributions and so on to influence that.
Yeah, thank you. That was a really thoughtful answer, Alex. If I might, could I ask you a personal question?
Sure.
You're Jewish. How did you get involved in what's essentially an opposition stance to the Israeli policy? You're not loyal the way that's at AIPAC would like you to be. How'd you get to where you started to where you are now?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I grew up Jewish in a liberal sort of family, but a secular family. We were never deeply, deeply religious, although, you know, we went to sort of synagogue on the high holy days, as many other Jewish families do. You know, one thing that sort of probably helped my political evolution along is that I did not grow up in a kind of heavily Zionist family. Israel was in the background in terms of Hebrew school, but it was not. So I don't have family in Israel. I don't have significant ties to Israel through my family. But so, and I first got sort of involved in sort of U.S. politics and writing about it after the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. And so when that happened, I was in high school then, but I began sort of going to demonstrations and getting involved with sort of larger social justice movements in the U.S. And so then in 2009, when Israel invaded Gaza, all of these things came together. I started to really look at this and say, well, what's going on? You know, the U.S. is in Iraq and Israel is bombing Gaza and, you know, sort of watching Al Jazeera English and all these horrific images of Palestinians being slaughtered in Gaza. And so I really became very interested through that. And I think many other people, Jews and even some non-Jews, became much more interested in Israel-Palestine when they saw these images from Gaza sort of on their iPhones, on their television screens, and began to wonder, you know, why is it that the U.S. is supporting this state? Why is it that we're not doing anything when, as Israel bombs Gaza and an open-air prison for all intents and purposes? So then after that, I went to the region. I went to Gaza for the first time. And since then, I've been very much interested in sort of U.S. foreign policy and U.S. policy towards Israel and the Palestinians.
Thank you very much, Alex Kane, for your thoughtful observations. And thank you for being a guest on Law and Disorder. We hope to have you back.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks, Alex.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.